morning. Let's all be seated. We are back on the record, and for the record, I'll just state this is the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's March 27th, 2019. We have reached the what was originally the fourth matter on our calendar, but it's the matter scheduled for 11:30 today. I'll ask the marshal to call the case. And I see that council are at council table, and I'll make just a few quick remarks. It looks like you have settled in and you're ready to proceed. So when you get to the podium, take your time to adjust the podium and bring whatever materials you need up to the podium. We're looking forward to our conversation with you today. Please make sure that you identify yourself for the record, as well as the client that you are here representing. But when you are ready, appellant, you can proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Lidia Villalba-Lijo, and I represent the appellant, Gregorio Zuniga Vallejo. In significant ways, this case and this appeal is about the statements that were made during the interrogation on November 16th of 2015. I'd like to begin with the wife's statements, which I may be referring to as the Crawford statements. Now, the state has conceded that these statements should not have been admitted under Crawford versus Washington, but that the admission of those statements was harmless. The exact opposite is true. The statements were harmful because even though the judge ruled that the wife could not testify, her statements in her own words and in her own voice were admitted, and they functioned the way that testimony would have functioned. This is exactly the scenario in the Crawford versus Washington case itself. The second reason it was harmful is that the statements were pervasive. They were pervasive during the interrogation, and they were also pervasive during the trial. They could not have been ignored by the jury. Third, the wife's statements were intertwined with the statements that were made by Mr. Zuniga Vallejo. And they were intertwined with the interrogation as a whole. And this created the risk that the jury would have had an extremely difficult time separating the wife's statements from those of Zuniga Vallejo. I'm sure that you've seen the transcript of the exhibit. It's rather complicated. There's four speakers in that transcript, and it's very complicated.
Sort of finishing one another's sentences and talking over each other. It seems like, I didn't listen to the audio, but it seems like it would have been hard to do just certain statements.
I agree with that, Your Honor. Just looking at the transcript and trying to sort out who the speakers are, and that goes to the point that I made earlier about the statements being intertwined. One person starting a statement, the second person finishing it. So it's a confusing document, and it was a confusing audio as well. Another point is that it cannot be underestimated the context in which these statements were made. This was an interrogation, a police interrogation. This was made during an active criminal investigation of a serious offense, first-degree meth possession. In addition, the statements were further reinforced because they were reproduced as part of the transcript that was used at trial. And as the Sweeney case noted, because she was Zuniga Vallejo's wife, the jury would have given great weight to the statements of the wife. Another point demonstrating that this was not harmless and actually was harmful was that the wife was an active participant in this interrogation. She answered many questions on her own. She volunteered answers. She finished responses. She asked questions. She had a conversation with her husband. She had communications directly with the police. And her responses at times filled in the details for the police. And finally, the wife's statements were incriminating. I've provided some examples on page 25 of appellant's brief, but I'll just touch on a few here. One is that the wife agreed that on October 22nd, she and Zuniga Vallejo were using methamphetamine, which goes to possession of meth on that date, in that and in the vicinity of where the offense occurred.
Well, their behavior was rather odd that day.
It was, Your Honor. It was, and
apart from anything she said.
And that was one reason, that was in fact how the officers began the conversation with Zuniga Vallejo and his wife, was that, you know, we're here to check on you. There have been some very strange incidents involving you recently. So it was sort of presented as a bit of a welfare check on them.
I went through and color-coded the transcript. So green is where your client answered a question or spoke, either in English or Spanish. And then yellow is where she translated, was speaking in, during translation for him. And then orange is where she spoke herself.
Okay.
So with regard to my green colored part of the transcript, what do we do with that, where he is either answering in English, answering questions, and speaking either in English, and sometimes he's answering in Spanish English questions? It doesn't seem that the Ramos case is implicated there.
That's a good point. That was something that I wanted to touch on in the second argument, but maybe now is a good time to touch on that. This case is distinguishable from Lopez Ramos, a case you're familiar with,
I am
both
familiar.
Of us.
I bet you were not happy to see I was on the panel.
Well, the opposite is true. I think it's a complicated issue, and I'm glad that you've had exposure to it.
Well, you're kind so, to say that.
It's true, but so this case is different than the Lopez Ramos case. Now, the Lopez Ramos case, I should just note, for Judge Rodenberg and Judge, is it Brattvold? Is that the correct
you're
pronunciation?
You're saying it correctly, yeah.
Okay,
go ahead.
Thank you. That this is a case that's currently pending before the Minnesota Supreme Court. And the question there is whether the declarant was the interpreter or whether the declarant was the defendant. Okay, so this case is different than Lopez Ramos, aside from the fact that we have an interpreter and a defendant. And it's distinguishable because the interpreter in this case was not a professional interpreter. Rather, this was the defendant's wife, who was also under some suspicion of drug activity herself. Maybe another way to look at it is she was also being interviewed. So she was not functioning as an interpreter or a translator. Another way to...
My question is more basic than that, though,
okay,
about
I'm sorry.
Her qualifications, if you will, to be an interpreter. Your client responded to a lot of questions on his own without an interpreter. And so I don't think in that, and with regard to those responses, that we even get to the interpreter cases.
Well, I would have to disagree to an extent with that. I mean, I think that Zuniga Vallejo's statements in English are clearly his own statements, and they come in because those are the statements of the defendant. I think his statements that were translated by the wife, you know, the statements that are...
But there are a number of statements where he just speaks Spanish and she doesn't translate.
That's correct, although at times, Judge Riley, she does summarize it. For instance, there's a point where she summarizes a statement. She is asked by the police.
And I've highlighted where she's speaking herself all in orange, so...
Maybe this goes to the point, or maybe this goes to the fact that these statements are so intertwined that her statements, none of her statements should be admitted, her own statements and her translated statements. Because this really highlights the problem that the jury would have had, because even statements that he makes in Spanish or that he makes in English, and frankly, some of his own statements are almost, they're close to incomprehensible. They are difficult to understand. But how it all gets characterized, just to put the summary, is how the wife is asked to characterize it by the police towards the end of the statement, which is, so you're agreeing that he said he took the drugs when he found out that we were coming and he hid it there in the Rudnick property. Is that right? And he never went back to pick it up. Is that right? Yes, that's right, is her response.
So that's the distinction between this case and Lopez Ramos, is that it's not a direct translation line by line.
That's one of the distinctions, Your Honor, is that it's not a direct translation. She is not only, and she is not clearly acting as a translator, or maybe it's more correct to say she is inconsistently acting as a translator. My reading of that transcript, and I also color-coded it as well, my reading of that transcript is she more often will ask the question in English. She doesn't always translate the statements that are directed to Zuniga Vallejo. She does not always translate the police statements to him. He is not always, a question is not always posed to him in Spanish so that
he's sometimes answering in Spanish to an English question.
That's correct. So she's not functioning strictly as a translator, although she does function that way at times. And it's also very accurate that the police rely on her as a translator, and they say that to her. I would point to some examples on page 11 and 12, page 15, 18, and 19 of the transcript, where the police themselves acknowledge her assistance as a translator. They say to her, "You helped us with translating today. Jacqueline, I want you to listen, because if Gregorio doesn't understand all this, I want you to be able to explain it to him." So they were relying on her or using her as a translator. But again, which actually, I'll just make the point very quickly, that actually is a factor that favors a finding that she was the declarant and not the, Mr. Zuniga Vallejo was not the declarant.
We have page 9, for instance, where they're asking about the week before Halloween, and the investigators are speaking in English, and he's responding in Spanish to their English questions, and she doesn't have a part of that.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at page 9, and that's correct. I don't see any... At the top have...
They're talking about the fingerprints, which
right.
is another issue that you raise, that you flag.
Yes, and this is really early on in the conversation. But again, just to point out, just to be clear, his own statements would have been admissible. But I think it's really the intertwined nature of the statement. Her translated statements should not have come in, and they were highly damaging. She makes the statement, I think it's on page 11 of the transcript, beginning around line 35, mm-hmm. where the police ask her, "Zuniga Vallejo has given an answer in Spanish," and you can see the translation on the right-hand side of the transcript there. "That's why, like when I talked to them, I took, and since I knew they were going to come, I grabbed it and I took it out." The police asked the wife to translate, and her translation is different, which further shows another problem and a concern with mistranslation. "He had it with him, but when he called you guys, he left it around there, so."
That is not what he said.
That's not what he said.
So and it's really a sort of a synopsis.
It's a synopsis that uses different words. The danger here is that this is the story, that the police ran with, and this is the story that the prosecutor ran with at trial, that when he was aware that police were coming, he took the item, he put it in the pumpkin patch, and he never went back. In 6 days, you know, it's left there. So I see that I'm just about out of time. If there's a question, I'm happy to take it.
Okay, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Karen McGillick. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I think it is important, first of all, to note, as I did in my brief, that there is a timeline here with regard to when the motions were made before trial and when the translated statement became available. That seems to be a little bit of a point of contention between the parties. I argued in my brief that at least with regard to exhibit one, or the first argument, which was whether or not the non-Mirandized statements of appellant should have come in, the district court at that point was relying solely on, I believe, the recording of the interview. There was certainly no evidence that the district court, when it decided that first motion to suppress, had certainly not a translated transcript. There may have been a transcript, but the Spanish portions translated to English were not contained in that. My understanding from appellant's brief was that she was challenging specific findings, findings 11, 14, 15, 16, and 17 from the first pretrial order. And that is why I wanted to point out that at that point, the court does not have, you know, the translated double column transcript that we all now have in the record that was admitted at trial. So at that point, the court is relying on the, you know, the exact English statements that came out and untranslated Spanish statements and having to rule on the motion based only on that information. And so I think it's important that we're reviewing the district court's order and its decision with that lens. We do understand that on June 6th of 2017 was when the translated transcript was prepared. I guess we read the court's record differently. In her reply brief, appellant's counsel has indicated that at that point it was exchanged between the parties. I do not see that in the record. I'm, of course, also relying on representations from the county attorney's office that are not part of the record and as to the timing of things, so I'm not going to present that here. But I don't see any evidence in the record that the district court would have had the actual translated transcript until trial. There is a reference in the court's third pretrial order to relying on the transcript, but it doesn't say that it's the translated transcript. So I think we have to assume that at that point, the court is still relying on an untranslated transcript, or at least there's nothing in the record to indicate for sure that the court ever had the translations. And so if we're getting into this sort of analysis of was the wife's translations line by line accurate or not, I don't think the court would have been able to have the benefit that we now have of a transcript to compare whether or not it was accurate or not, because the court just didn't have that information.
I am curious to hear your response to the argument. You say that under Swaney it was error to admit the wife's statements.
Correct.
But you say it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But opposing counsel makes some really good points about how intertwined what was said during this interview or interrogation, her statements, with what the appellant is saying. So how can you say that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
For two reasons. Number one, when we're looking at the statements, they can be separated, I think, into three categories. There's the defendant's own statements that he made. There are the wife's translations of the defendant's statement, which I would say defendant is the declarant of those statements. And then there's the wife's own statements. Now, when you look at the transcript,
To the argument, which makes sense to me, that some of the translation, it's not verbatim, it's it's more the gist of what he's saying. So that's, is that translation?
Well, again, we're what I'm understanding is that she's challenging three categories of statements, and when we're talking about the wife's statements, we're not talking about her translations of appellant's statement where appellant is the declarant. We're talking in this third argument about her own statements, not translating whether or not those are accurate. That's where we were willing to concede, and I think we have to concede under Supreme Court precedent that, you know, she did offer statements in response to express questioning, and so certainly we have to say under Crawford that those are testimonial. But just because they were testimonial, you still need to look at the balance of, again, not the appellant's or the defendant's statements, not her translations of his statements, but just her own statements. And the reason it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is that we're talking about such a small number of statements that can be attributed only to the wife. And most of those statements relate to just sort of harmless background information that have nothing to do with anything incriminating. And so they're really not very persuasive. Her confirmation that they both used methamphetamine, I mean, it's not a good thing, but it certainly isn't going to be the linchpin evidence that's going to convict appellant of actually possessing the meth that they found in the garden that day. And you have to compare the fact that whatever her own individual, that third category of statements are, they're very minor when you compare them to the defendant's own incriminating statements that he made that were there. And of course, the eyewitness testimony of the officers that were at the scene, who saw the behavior, who were able to link the finding of the methamphetamine to the location where he was that day outside of that individual's home. There's so much other evidence that when you look at her own statements, they're very minor and they're not particularly compelling against the evidence as a whole. And that's why we can say that, okay, her own statements may have been testimonial under Crawford, but there's certainly the admission of those statements is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
In that second category, the wife's translation is what I think you called it. Mm-hmm. Just looking at the section that Ms. Liho was talking about,
page 11,
lines 35 to 39, this is sort of unlike Lopez-Ramos. It is unlike Lopez-Ramos because after he says the lines por eso and whatever, no one does a direct translation of that at any point. Instead, what we have is the wife's synopsis of what he said, which is being offered for the truth of the matter that she is asserting that that's what he meant. Did that make any sense?
I believe so.
It's not like Lopez-Ramos, where make a statement, direct translation of statement. Make another statement, direct translation of statement. There's some conversation back and forth, and then at the end of it, she says, here's what he meant.
Mm-hmm. I will concede that that is a slightly different piece of fact for this case versus the other. However, again, we have to look at the timing of when these motions came to the court, the fact that it was the defendant's burden to challenge the accuracy of these statements at trial. If the defendant wanted to claim below in the trial court that the statements were not an accurate translation or that they shouldn't be considered, then the defendant should have done that at the time and chose not to. So at no point did the defendant ever claimed that his wife did not accurately translate the gist of what he was saying. Now, again, she's not a professional translator. She wasn't purporting to line by line, word by word, but she did give the gist. And the reason in my brief that I tried very hard to just sort of say, okay, a statement was made in Spanish and then here's the answer and not actually give the English translation is because, again, at the point that the court is deciding this motion, the court didn't have the English statement to say whether or not it was accurate. And so what we have is a question that was given to the defendant and his wife converse in Spanish, and then she comes back and says he had it with him, but when he called you guys, he left it around there, so.
I do disagree with you. I think the prosecution and the state has the burden to make sure that when they're trying cases, they don't violate the constitutional rights of defendants. And that would include the Confrontation Clause.
Of course, yes.
And so to say the burden was on him with regard to what's in this transcript, I think has it backwards a little bit.
I'm not saying that the state doesn't ultimately have the burden of proof, and certainly the state needs to guard against.
No, I'm saying the state has more than the burden of proof. The state has the responsibility to make sure that the state isn't violating a defendant's constitutional rights.
Absolutely. And my point with regard to his burden on the translation is I believe there is information in the pretrial record about, if you look through the transcripts of the pretrial hearings, where the parties exchanged and it was given to the defendant, okay, if there's going to be a challenge, if there's going to be something where you want us to bring it to the court's attention of any errors, please do so, and he never did. And so, you know, it was my understanding that the parties essentially stipulated or conceded that the transcript was accurate and that the state was going to offer it for that purpose.
And where is that in the record?
I believe that is in the pretrial when this, I don't have a citation in front of me, but there was in the pretrial hearings where these motions were brought up, there was discussions at the time, I believe it would have been the June 6th when the, I think it's June 6th, 2017, when the transcript was prepared and discussed prior to the second motion. I believe that at that point, I don't have the transcript in front of me, but there was, you know, references in the record to the fact that the parties were supposed to look it over and make sure that it was accurate and bring any type of motion if there was a problem with it. So I don't think that the defendant ever raised that as an issue below. And, you know, essentially he's adopting his wife's translation of what he said as his own statement. And I do believe that when a question is posed, it's translated and said back, even if it isn't a verbatim, which we can now say looking at the translation that it's not verbatim, the gist of it is still there, and it's still a summary of the declarant's statement, and that's what it was being offered for. This was a conversation occurring between two investigators and a husband and wife in their home. You know, this wasn't court testimony with a translator who was hired by the state to sit there and word for word go through it. I mean, the cops understood that they were asking questions, that they were speaking, and then they would come back and she would explain it. And then you could tell from the context of the conversation that as it moves forward, appellant would then either reiterate similar information or he would say other things to add on to it. And so the context is important too, because you can tell that he's understanding what his wife has translated and he's continuing to expound on that in his own statements. You know, the district court also made an explicit finding here that he believed the defendant understood a lot more English than he was alleging, and that some of these Spanish interactions back and forth were really his way to try to either signal to his wife that he didn't want her to say something or that they would say something that he didn't want the cops to say, but that he did understand what was going on and was able to communicate. And in fact, that's very obvious at times when there are English questions posed and he will jump in and kind of interrupt and put in a statement first before his wife could answer. So I don't think this is a situation of a person that's, for example, not able to speak English at all and is relying only on a translator to communicate. There's a significant amount of English that this defendant was able to speak. So again, you know, I think it's important to separate out when we are talking about the conceded error and harmless error of the wife's statements. We're talking a very small number of statements that are actually attributed to her and are not either translations of his statements or his own statements. And I think that's the major distinction here. You know, we have gone through a significant analysis in the brief on all three types of statements and why they were brought in. And I think when we look at the translations under section 2 of our briefs, again, we're talking about basically two lines in the whole entire transcript that she translated for him. So we're not talking about a significant number of things. And my understanding was the challenges to her statement that he had it with him, but when he called you guys, he left it around there. And then him saying he needs to work to pay it off. That's at page 11. Now, he needs to work to pay it off is also relevant in the context of appellant saying in English, I need to work. The investigator is saying, what was that? And then she saying, he needs to work to pay it off. You know, it's really more of a, I think the officer didn't hear the answer and she sort of repeated it. It's in some ways not even really a translation as much as a repeating it so he could hear it better. So we're not talking about a significant number of statements. The vast majority of the incriminating statements that came in were appellant's own words, and were appellant's own words in English. So, and those, there doesn't seem to be much of a dispute that those are certainly admissible in the context of this. Now, I know we did argue in our briefs over, you know, whether or not he was in custody or not, and I think we can rely on our briefs for those arguments, that the state would certainly maintain that for Miranda purposes, he was not in custody. This was not a custodial interrogation that would trigger Miranda, so the fact that he was not Mirandized between making these statements does not make them admissible. They were properly admitted, and they could be used against him. And those are the statements that really ultimately assisted the state in convicting the defendant. And not only that, those statements were offered in addition to a significant amount of other corroborating evidence that established that the statements he was making were true. I can see that I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to stop now unless you have some additional questions.
Thank you, okay. Counsel.
Thank you very much, Court.
Hi. I would just like to respond to a few points by the prosecutor. One is that she acknowledged, I think that we've all acknowledged, this is a difficult record. It's a very messy record. It's a very difficult record to get through. And so I appreciate everyone taking the time to go through it. Now, with regard to the translation, in the reply brief, I took a good amount of time to try to point out in the record, and specifically with regard to the judge's orders, because there were multiple pretrial motions filed and multiple orders that the judge filed. And so if you could please take some time to read through that reply brief, it's where I try to highlight that there is reference to the transcript and reference to a completed transcript. I would agree with the state that the record could be better here. It could be more clear, but it is what we have. And given the rulings that are made, and also this transcript, this is an important point, was available at the point where the defense moved to exclude the wife's statements based on the marital privilege, based on the Crawford case, and based on her acting as translator. So the transcript was available at that point.
So how do you respond to her belief, and I know that neither of you were the trial attorneys in this case, that at the pretrial motions, and she cites to June 6, 2017, that the transcript had been prepared and discussed, and defendants or appellants, trial counsel, didn't object to the accuracy of it. What's your response to that?
I think overall, I do recall in the record, unfortunately, I cannot put my finger on it right now. I do recall, I do recall an objection by the defense to the use of her as the translator overall, a statement by the defense in the motion that, you know, our position is that none of this is accurate because she wasn't a trained interpreter. And that was one of his initial objections was, wait a minute, she can't be an interpreter. He was entitled to a qualified interpreter. She wasn't. Therefore, this entire interrogation is not trustworthy. Now, as to specific challenges, the way that we are doing now and the way that we've done appeal, there was no specific challenge. However, the reason that we are talking about specific mistranslation and miscommunication is because that goes to the harm. That goes to the harm. So we're not talking about reversing because there were mistranslations. We're talking about reversing because the wife's statements should not have been admitted because they violated the defendant's rights under Crawford. And the wife's translated statements should not have been admitted because they too violate Zuniga Vallejo's Crawford rights and also are inconsistent with Lopez Ramos. So, and the pointing out examples of mistranslations, I'm using that to demonstrate harm. And just one point, because, again, it is very confusing. But we're challenging, I think it's clear by now, but we're challenging two types of statements made by the wife. Her own statements, her own declarations, and that's what I'm calling the Crawford statements, and the state has conceded that those should not have come in. We're arguing, and they were also harmless. So that is a basis for reversing. And then we are also challenging what we describe as her translated statements or her Lopez, I'm calling them the Lopez-Ramos statements. So if I have 39 seconds, so I'm going to make a very quick point about the Miranda because I'm kind of chomping at the bit on that. Okay, this was a custodial statement. I would recommend the court to read Champion. Champion relies on the game-changing statement made by the defendant, a highly incriminating statement. Well, here, we have not only an incriminating statement made by Zuniga Vallejo, we have a clear statement by the police that preceded that, that told him, we think you are involved in drug activity. We think you left that packet over at the Rudnick property. Zuniga Vallejo then says, he acknowledges a few moments later that he left a packet there, and then further, he identifies the picture, the packet in the picture as what's being talked about, and if there's any doubt at all that this was custodial, please look towards the end of the exhibit where the police clearly tell Zuniga Vallejo that we could go to, they tell him and the wife, we could go to the county attorney and he could be charged with first-degree methamphetamine possession. Well, sure enough, 3 days, the complaint is filed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The matter was well briefed and well argued, and it's now submitted to this court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame.
So that concludes.